developing emotional agility, the ability to move between extreme emotions and complex situations, and to be flexible.
Welcome to Your Intended Message, the perfect place for leaders and promising professionals who want to convey the intended message for greater success. Every week, we interview experts who address the challenges and best practices to deliver your message effectively. That might be one-to-one, one-to-few, or one-to-many. And perhaps the most important conversation, one-to-self. I'm your host, George Torok.
My guest today is Dr. Joseph Stern. Here's three facts that I believe you should know about him. One, he is a neurosurgeon. For him, it is brain surgery. It is literally. Two, he's spoken and published. He's had a TED Talk. He's published articles in the New York Times, the Washington Post. And most importantly, he has a book called Grief Connects Us, A Neurosurgeon's Lessons on Love, Loss, and Compassion. And three, he thought he understood what it felt like to be a patient until his younger sister, Victoria, developed leukemia, had a bone marrow transplant, and then she died. It was only then that he realized how little he knew about that process. He then set out to learn about connecting with people, with patients, in that process, that connection between doctor and patients and family during the process of dying or near dying. Dr. Joseph Stern, Jody, he told me to call him Jody. Jody, welcome to Your Intended Message.
Thanks, George. It's a pleasure to be here.
Jody, you went through, it's funny how we have to go through trauma before we wake up to what's really going on around us. As a neurosurgeon, you're expected to be good at the technical side. I mean, if I'm going under in surgery, I want to make sure that the doctor can do the work. I don't want a funny guy. I want a guy who's real serious about the work. However, there's another part to what you do. And that part, I believe, you discovered was missing. And what was that piece that was missing?
So everything is about the focus on training and education as a neurosurgeon is about becoming technically proficient and mastering very difficult subject matter. But we're working with people, and these people are generally terrified. And whether or not they're dying, they need a compassionate connection with their doctor. And that's where I feel that in neurosurgery training, but particularly in medicine, I think we fall down on the job in terms of the importance of what it is to connect with patients and with what they're going through. So I feel that that was what my sister brought to me. It wasn't so much that I was, that it's only when people are dying, it's that anyone who is getting medical care is at a low point and needs a compassionate connection. And you need to have shared vulnerability and an ability to communicate in an empathic way with the patient.
And you're right, it goes beyond, it's more than just dying. Dying, of course, is the extreme. It could be something as simple as a person being called in to take tests and wondering, well, what did you find? What can you tell me? What are my choices? And the doctors just kind of look, well, it's not my part to tell you that.
Well, it becomes very routine for us if we're doing this all the time. And yet if you're going through this is a big deal, and it's all a big deal, and a lot of times you don't understand it and it's scary and you need help and someone to guide you through it. And one of the things I found when I had this experience with my sister was that I not only needed to develop a compassionate, less detached, less technical stance, but I need to be able to flex between extremes, to be able to go from, you know, you don't want a sponge as a doctor. You said you don't want a funny guy. You don't want someone who's kind of, you know, making light of it, because the surgery is crucial and needs to be done with expertise. But you need to be able to flex between a pretty extreme range of emotions. I need to be able to have a meaningful, empathetic connection and communication conversation with you. Say you have a brain tumor, we're talking about whether you're going to live or die and what the rest of your life looks like. And then I need to be able to shift into a technical and precise mode to take out your brain tumor. And so one of the things that I struggled with was when you open up to the need for compassion, because you see when doctors aren't compassionate, they have overly technical or tend to objectify patients. They treat them as objects. They don't treat them as people. They don't you feel like they're not working within your best, with their best interests and at heart. So then you need to be able to flex into a more a pretty wide range. And one of the things that was very helpful, and Helen Rice was extremely helpful for me, and I know she was a guest of yours, is developing emotional agility, the ability to move between extreme emotions and complex situations and to be flexible. So those are some of the things I wanted to talk about and also that I discovered and propelled me to write my book.
Now, I'm reminded, and pardon me for being a child of MASH, a fan of MASH. And I think of how when they're in surgery, they're serious, but then they go back to their tent and they pour themselves a drink and make jokes. Is that the kind of emotional agility you're talking about?
No, you know, George, one of the things I discovered, not only is compassion and that empathetic connection is important for patients, but it turns out that how we manage our own emotional lives is very important for us as people and as physicians. So I think that there's a lot of a tendency to kind of, I think in MASH would be an example of someone blowing off steam. You know, they're dealing with being exposed to traumas they don't know how to handle. So they drink and they carry on and they do a lot of acting out of those emotions. But I think actually to experience them or to lean into them, to have to accept and be willing to experience the vulnerability that is required of developing that connection with people, it turns out that's really important for you as well. That's a way to, for me, what I discovered is you think that you're blocking the perception of grief or loss by keeping your distance, but that really doesn't provide a barrier. All that does is provides it makes it difficult for you to be able to let that guard down. So when you have the guard up at work, it's hard to just let it down at home. And that guard becomes somewhat constricting. And I call it emotional armor. It becomes like a straitjacket. It sort of defends you, but the defense doesn't actually work. And so when I realized that I didn't want it anymore, getting rid of the emotional armor, it exposes you to extremes of experiences. But at the same time, those extremes are where life and the meaning and the joy and the subtlety of life is all about. So you have to get rid of the armor, but you have to be able to flex between armor or between exposure and also the distance associated with needed for doing surgery.
Now, as a neurosurgeon, when you started getting rid of your emotional armor, how did you make the transition between being vulnerable and then being technically competent in surgery? Because there's a transition there, and is there a mantra? Is there a process you go through mentally, or do you just flip a switch?
Well, I wish it were that easy. It turns out it's very difficult. I read quite a bit about it. I used friends and colleagues to kind of help me. And I would also say that the experience wasn't really one entirely of my own choosing. It was one, you know, what you said at the beginning, George, is entirely true, which is that these experiences propel you, they require you to change. It wasn't as if this was a deliberate decision. My sister's illness penetrated that armor. I realized it no longer worked. Then I started to realize it actually never worked. And I realized I needed to get rid of it. But that was a multi-year process. And one of the things that I wanted to communicate in my book, I guess my intended message to your audience, is that you're a stronger, better person by allowing yourself to be vulnerable. You connect more meaningfully with patients and also with yourself. And I needed to get rid of that burden, what I thought was protecting me that wasn't, to develop a closer connection with people. And it's been a a quite a long process. There's a really good book by a woman named Susan David who writes a book. The book is called Emotional Agility. And what she says in the book, which I think is true, is that life's beauty is inseparable from its fragility. If you are going to those points of contact, those points of meaning, and we tend to shy away from those, we tend to, you know, substitute technology or substitute a treatment instead of that connection. That's where the real beauty and wonder of life is. And so I would say that that process of developing emotional agility is a kind of a lifetime work. It's not easy, but you always have to kind of be true to yourself and be willing to go to places that you ordinarily aren't entirely comfortable going.
Your sister, Victoria, the process that she went through, that the experience that she had, was she in the dark with in terms of her treatment? Did you, when you were talking to her, now as a neurosurgeon, as a person who works in healthcare, you certainly would understand the system, the process about what was going on around her, and I imagine you tried to help her and comfort her and try to understand what was happening. Were you frustrated with her, the lack of compassion that she received, and was there a moment, and I know this is a longer question, but was there a moment when it suddenly hit you in the face saying, Jody, this system isn't working the way it should be?
There were a couple of moments just that were kind of starkly felt like that. An intake interview at a different hospital where the doctor had said, you know, your treatment had totally failed, and she was just sort of devastated by that. So there was some mild insensitivity, but it was more the whole process and the whole, you know, when her bone marrow transplant didn't take and she had a relapse very early, her likelihood of survival was a 6% 5-year survival chance. But she didn't want to talk about dying, and the doctors didn't talk about dying. So they substituted different kinds of chemotherapy and kind of kept the ball rolling. And I felt that was a lost opportunity. Part of it was my sister. My sister didn't want to talk about the idea that she might die. So she really wasn't interested in going there. But I felt that was a missed opportunity to connect. And the whole process feels very, a little bit on the cold side. You know, that really came home to me. It's amazing how, you know, as a neurosurgeon, you say, well, you understand what's going on with leukemia. It turns out you don't. I mean, bone marrow transplant's very complicated. So I understood some, but not that much. But a year and a half after my sister died, her husband, Pat, had a ruptured aneurysm in his brain. And he ended up in the hospital at UCLA. They lived in California. And he was in the ICU there for 2 weeks. And then we had to withdraw treatment and let him die. And I found myself, I was his healthcare power of attorney. It was really my field. So this was neurosurgery. I understood and lived that. And it's an amazing thing when you kind of take a step back or you shift roles in a patterned behavior that you really understand, or you think you understand, but really you only understand your role in that pattern. And then you suddenly come at it as a patient's family member. It felt very technical and very methodical but often lacking in compassion. So that was really a shock, was how tough it is, what people, the things that they have to go through, how enormously consuming it is to be a patient. For example, just simple things like, you know, you have children. Well, you have to find daycare. You're basically in the hospital, you know, 24/7 for weeks on end. Everyone came up from all across the country. It's so disruptive and so disorienting. And really, it was a funny thing because the nurses were so kind and were so, I remember came into UCLA and was there and didn't know my way around. There was no one to greet us. It was a Sunday morning. I went up to the neuro ICU and this nurse came out to meet me and it gave me a big hug. Something as simple as that was so powerful. And you found in the whole experience, there really wasn't much of that. There really wasn't that human contact, that human connection, that caring, that saying, you know, that we're here with you. We get what you're going through. We're partners with you. And it's so, the thing about compassion is, you know, when you see it, when you're experiencing it, and you know, when you don't. And it's a big ask for doctors to be all technical. And now I'm saying, you have to do the compassion part too. I think where I see it being very successful is much more in the team effort, where people are working together and really kind of bringing, offloading some of the stress and responsibility on the doctor. The doctor doesn't have to do everything, doesn't have to be the source of compassion, but together as a team, you can make a huge difference.
Mm. And I'm assuming that you have become a more compassionate doctor, more compassionate surgeon. What language have you started to use more of that you didn't use before?
I think I listen more. I listen more and try to talk less. I sit and I give people time, and I want to hear what they are concerned about and what matters to them. And so I feel that the meaningful relationships with patients are really what sustain me. That actually, by the time I'm fairly advanced in my career, I've been doing a surgery for a long time. I like doing surgery, but I also really like the relationship, the trust that the patients are put in me and kind of our relationship. So I cultivate that. I also think that I'm not afraid to ask questions about, what they're feeling or what their goals are and what it is that they're experiencing, what is it they're worried about, what scares them. So I think a lot of times in the past, I probably would have shut down, a topic like that and moved on to a medical treatment or, bombing people with facts. So, I'm going to give them all the facts about their illness. And it's in reality, there are multiple planes of communication that are going on at the same time. One is the fact information dump, which a lot of times doctors do. But the other is like, what are you experiencing? What are you taking away from this? What are your worries? What are your goals? What concerns you here? And I think that those ability or willingness to get a little bit uncomfortable, maybe to cry, but more to listen.
As you look back on what you've learned, what do you wish you did differently for Victoria?
I think that she was absolutely terrified. And, she said she didn't want to even consider the idea that she might die. And it was almost a foregone conclusion at the beginning. And I feel that I kind of let her down when I didn't take that uncomfortable path. I was worried that she would block me out, that she, would say, you were my advisor because you played by the rules. But if you stop, playing by my rules, you're no longer welcome. But I felt that I didn't take that uncomfortable step that was necessary to really help her through that process.
And I recall a good friend of mine who was a mentor to me. He died from cancer, and I remember when he first was diagnosed, he was fighting. He was positive. He said, I'm going for the treatment. I can visualize the little soldiers inside my body fighting for me. And I remember and he was that kind of a positive person. And then he got to the point where, it became stage 4, and he somehow made that transition. And I remember meeting with him, and he was calm. Like he was calm. He could even joke about it, but he somehow made that transition himself from being the fighter to the okay. I know what's going to happen. I just don't know when. And he was calm. He knew what he had to do, and that was an amazing transition that he made. And he seemed to be more interested in making the people around him feel good about it.
Well, George, I'm sorry about your loss. You sound like you cared a lot about it. The excuse me a sec. The it's really hard, you know, because we're all going to die. We're all going to get sick. And one of the things I did in my book was my sister wrote a journal of her illness, and I incorporated that into the book. She was an actress. She was very vital and exuberant. And I, she wrote a journal. She said she was going to write a journal about, or a play, a one woman play about surviving leukemia. And then it became a testament to her experience and suffering and kind of worries. But then I took my own personal journey. And after that, I interviewed a bunch of doctors and a bunch of patients and how they struggle with all these things. And one of the things I do think that doctors do, you know, some people say, well, doctors die differently than other people. I think the way we use information, the way we're less automatically trusting of what other people say. You know, we want to understand data, but we also don't have this sort of doctor's God complex. I'm going to do what the doctor says, and whatever the doctor says, I'll do. So I think having knowledge about what you may be going through or what potentially is going to happen and adjusting as you go. So what your friend did of kind of, you know, shifting priorities, I think is super important. And I think also one of the things that I advocate for in this book is we don't plan and we don't discuss these things in advance, right? So we're all going to die. And yet as a culture, we're phobic of death. We don't talk about dying. We don't make plans about dying. We don't talk about, you know, living wills and advanced directives and all these things. And so it becomes such a, you're inventing it for the first time, and yet it's inevitable. And this idea, I think, like that my sister had, where she was determined not to go there and that would somehow protect her, is, to me, doesn't work. You know, it's not, you allow yourself to, if you go in with that approach, yes, you're courageous, but you also allow yourself to just get battered by these treatments. And sometimes they don't make sense. I felt in her case as if her continued chemotherapy was a bit of a magic show, you know, keep the balls spinning and we can avoid the painful topics that are behind them.
Jody, your book, Grief Connects Us, you wrote it specifically, I believe, for healthcare professionals. Who else might gain from that, and what would they gain?
So I actually wrote it for everybody. I wrote it for informed readers. I think that the messages for healthcare providers are important, but I also think the messages for patients are important and families. And one of the things that I want to get across is that this divide between doctor and patient is a bit artificial. We're all in it together. You see it with COVID, you know, the doctors are trying to make reasonable judgments and help people out, but we're all at risk. And so I actually think that what one of my goals is not to distinguish so much between doctor and patient. You know, we all have these experiences. These are all going to be life-changing, life-altering experiences. And instead of waiting for yourself to get hit over the head with one of these painful, wrenching experiences, you know, give it some thought in advance. Maybe think about what this might be like, how you would deal with this, how have the painful conversations we never want to have in advance, so we can make plans and talk about what's important to us. So I think it's actually a book that is for everybody. And one of the things that's been very gratifying to me is that patients and family members have read it and have said it helped them. It's helped them to grieve. It's helped them to process what they've gone through. And so my journey is only a window into a more universal experience that I'm trying to tap into, that I want people to come away with a better appreciation of what they've gone through, what they're going through, what their family members go through, and you know, connect the dots. So it's intended for curious people.
And Jody, let's say you have a chance to talk to a graduating class of healthcare professionals, whether it's doctors or nurses, and you could give them advice about compassion, one, how to show it, but also at the same time, how not to drain themselves. What would you say to them?
Well, we're looking at a time in healthcare where burnout is at very, very high rates. And I believe that some of the reason for burnout is we're not kind to ourselves. So there's no self-compassion. We don't take time to make sure that we're okay. And because we push away the grief and these other experiences, it ends up being a very fragile relationship that we have when we could really dig in and be more connected and get more pleasure and more value out of work. And so I would urge them to make some of these transitions toward, you know, honest communication, really being in touch with their own emotional experiences, not shying away from these connections and conversations, and the emotional agility part that, you know, you need to really, to be a successful provider of healthcare, you need to be able to have that connection and also have the technical expertise. And if you can learn to balance between those two, you're really going to be a very wonderful provider.
Jody, one of the challenges is that patients always see the doctor as the authority figure. Mm-hmm. And we have not been trained to question the doctor. In fact, we don't even know the questions to ask. What advice would you give to patients who are receiving healthcare, whether it's critical healthcare or just regular healthcare? What advice would you give to them so that they can maybe encourage the compassion to come out from the healthcare provider? Because someone's got to start the exchange of compassion. It might not be the doctor. What can we do? What can I do when I go to my doctor and say to get a little bit more compassion?
George, are you intimidated by your doctor, or do you feel comfortable having regular conversations?
I can have a conversation, yes. And probably I've gained that from this interview type process. So I'm used to talking to people who are playing a different field than me. However, my father is intimidated.
I think there's a lot of times there's a generational component. You know, I will talk to patients and I'll say, you know, what do you want, or what, and they'll just say, well, whatever you want is whatever you tell me to do is what I'll do. And I go, well, really, we need to get beyond that. You know, it was funny when I was putting together my TED talk, and I said in my TED talk, you know, you need that bedside manner is very important. It's not just window dressing, and you need to be able to have that relationship and that connection with your doctor. And if you don't find it with their doctor, then choose another one. So I feel that we're far more powerful than we like to think we are. We can make decisions. We can advocate for ourselves. But it was interesting because the guy who was putting on this talk said, well, you can't say that. And I said, well, why can't you say that? He said, well, you know, it's easy for you to say you're a doctor. You can switch doctors. I couldn't switch doctors. I didn't like my doctor. And I was stuck in that relationship. And I said, well, you know, I think that that's part of the problem, is this sort of top-down approach. Whereas you have to be able to say, are my needs being met? And do I really know what my needs are? You know, so I think that's super important. One of the things that I find interesting about your show, your intended message, I really like, is how I don't think that this is a healthcare segment. Okay. I think this is what is compassion important? Okay. And to me, compassion is a key component. And a lot of times it's being drowned out or pushed out. And relationships, the way we, you know, business relationships or personal relationships are losing that kind of compassionate thread. And I feel that that's one of the key things that has to be allowed to flourish. And it's getting kind of drowned down. We're getting mean to each other. We're not treating each other well. We're not listening to each other. So these components that I came to understand in sort of a life-death arena, I think are applicable in lots of areas.
And Jody, in wrapping up, let's look at society in as whole, or the workplace in whole, outside the healthcare. Let's look at the role that compassion plays. If you could offer one, two, or three pieces of advice to organization leaders to encourage them, to help them become more compassionate while still appearing to be a leader, what might be that advice? How can they encourage compassion in their team?
So first of all, I think the vulnerability part is really important. You have to allow yourself to be vulnerable, and you have to, and I think that leaders often feel that that's a sign of weakness, and I actually think it's a sign of strength. So shared vulnerability or willingness to be vulnerable. I think also in healthcare, one of the things that I think is a problem is that healthcare organizations advocate for compassion in their workforce. You know, your job as nurse or doctor is to be compassionate toward the patient, but they don't advocate for that same level of compassion for the workers. And where you have selective compassion or transactional compassion, it's not really truly compassionate. So if I'm, you know, I had a nurse tell me that he was taking care of dying patient and their family. And he really loved that was super important. And then immediately upon the death of the patient, they said, well, you have another assignment. So no chance to grieve or process what they've gone through, you know, on to more productivity. And so I think that being honest, allowing people to develop those compassionate behaviors is important. And maintaining, being true to your espoused, are your espoused values the same as your enacted values? Are you really doing what you're saying? You know, when marketing takes over and says, well, we're going to show how compassionate we are, because then we want to get more throughput and we want to capture more patients. But meanwhile, the providers are struggling with the volume and demands placed on them. That's not compassionate. So you can say it's compassionate, but is it really? I think that if leaders were really to say, is this something I would be okay with? Would I thrive in this situation? Or how can I change the situation so that I would do well and other people will achieve their greatest results? I think those things would be super important. The other thing I would say is also, if you work toward the survey, you're going to get to a certain level of performance. But if you work toward these core values and really allow them to permeate your organization, you'll achieve a level of success that you almost wouldn't believe would be possible.
My guest today is Dr. Joseph Stern, reminding you that beauty in life is inseparable from its fragility.
If you like what you heard, remember to like, comment, and share this podcast. Come back every week for more practical insights to help you deliver your intended message. I'm your host, George Torok.